Welcome back, everyone, to another deep dive with us. Today, we're going to be taking a look at a case that's really important for anyone out there dealing with government payments, and that is Universal Health Services v. Escobar.
Definitely a big one, especially for those in healthcare, absolutely.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. We're wading into some deep False Claims Act territory here, folks. And specifically, we're going to be unpacking how this case really, it reshaped the whole landscape of implied full certification, right?
Yeah, for sure.
You know, those tricky situations where you have regulatory violations that can end up leading to some pretty hefty SEA penalties.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I think what's really fascinating about Escobar is it's not just about, you know, these kind of like technical violations, right?
Right.
It really dives into what matters most to the government when they're deciding whether or not to pay a claim. It gets kind of murky.
Yeah, it does. And I think to really grasp that, to really understand that, we need to start with a story that's at the heart of this case. And, you know, it is a tragic story.
It is.
And it involves a teenager named Yerushka Rivera. She was receiving mental health services at Arbor Counseling, a subsidiary of Universal Health Services. And sadly, she passed away after a very severe reaction to medication.
Yeah.
But the real shock, the real kind of like, oh my gosh, moment came when her parents started digging deeper and they uncovered some disturbing truths about the staff who were treating their daughter.
Yeah. I mean, imagine, like you said, it's already tragic, right?
Absolutely.
And then you find out that this psychologist providing care to your child, to your daughter, didn't even have a legitimate degree.
Didn't even have an accredited degree, yeah.
Like, wow.
And then the nurse who was prescribing medication.
Right. Wasn't properly supervised according to state regulations.
Yeah. So these aren't, you know, these aren't just minor oversights we're talking about here, right?
No.
These are serious breaches of professional standards.
Absolutely.
And here's where it gets even more complicated, right?
Yeah.
Because all the while, UHS is billing Medicaid for these services. And they're using codes that imply, that basically say, hey, we're in full compliance with all the regulations.
Everything is fine. Yep. Nothing to see here.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's exactly where the False Claims Act comes into play.
Oh, yeah. The FCA.
As I'm sure many of you know, the FCA has these really powerful quintam provisions.
Powerful. Yeah.
And they let private citizens, like Yerushka's parents in this case, sue on behalf of the government for fraud.
That's huge.
And not only that, they can get a share of any money recovered if they're successful.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, things didn't go smoothly through the courts with this case. Right?
Oh, no. Not at all.
The district court initially dismissed it.
Yeah.
And their reasoning was that those licensing issues, like the psychologist not having the right degree, the nurse not being supervised, they argued those weren't technically conditions of payment, so they weren't directly tied to UHS's billing.
Interesting.
But then the First Circuit Court of Appeals, they reversed that decision.
They did.
And they brought in this whole idea of implied false certification
yeah.
as their argument.
Right.
Saying, yeah. Look, by submitting these claims and implying compliance, mm-hmm. UHS was essentially misleading the government.
Right.
And it doesn't even matter if those specific regulations were spelled out as payment conditions.
Yeah, makes sense.
And this wasn't just some, you know, legal technicality. The whole idea of implied false certification was causing all sorts of ripples in courts across the country. Different courts were interpreting it differently.
Right.
That's why the Supreme Court decided to step in and settle this.
Okay.
To give everyone a clear playbook to follow.
Right. Because so they had two really big questions they had to tackle, right?
Huge.
The first one was, is this theory, this implied false certification, is it even valid? Can we use it for lawsuits under the FCA?
Right.
And then the second one was, okay, so if it is valid, what are the specific conditions someone has to meet to actually be held liable under this theory? I mean, this potentially impacts a huge range of cases.
Oh, yeah, far beyond just healthcare, for sure.
Yeah.
So before we get into the Supreme Court's decision, let's make sure everyone's on the same page here.
Yeah, they do.
Implied false certification. What does that even mean, right?
Right.
Think of it this way, and I think this is an easy analogy. You're a contractor, you're building a bridge for the government, right?
Okay.
And you submit your invoices, you're like, hey, pay me, I built the bridge.
I did the work.
But you've secretly skipped some really crucial safety inspections, mm-hmm. you know, to save money.
Oh, sneaky.
So by sending that invoice, you're implying, hey, this bridge has been built according to all the regulations, everything's fine, pay me.
Right.
But behind the scenes, there are these hidden dangers.
Yeah.
That's implied false certification.
Makes sense.
So back to the big showdown What did the Supreme Court decide?
Okay, so they actually upheld the implied false certification theory.
Wow, okay.
Big win for whistleblowers. But they also set a pretty high bar for proving liability. They said two very specific conditions have to be met.
So what are these magic conditions that everyone's got to know?
Okay, the first one is the claim itself has to make specific representations. So like, you know, those billing codes that UHS used.
Okay, yeah.
Those are explicit statements about the services being provided.
Right.
And then the second condition is that non-compliance with a material requirement has to make those representations misleading.
Materiality. We're hearing that word a lot. Mm. What does that even mean in this context? It's not just breaking any old rule, right?
You're right. It's not just any violation. It has to be material, which basically means it has to be significant enough that the government would likely have refused to pay if they knew about it.
Okay.
And here's another interesting twist. The rule that's violated, it doesn't actually have to be explicitly labeled as a condition of payment to be considered material.
So even if some obscure regulation is tucked away deep in some government manual, if it's something they really care about, violating it could still trigger FCA liability.
That's right. The Supreme Court really emphasized the importance of materiality. It's all about the impact on the government's decision-making. Would they have paid if they knew the truth?
Yeah, that's the key question. So in Yarushka Rivera's case, you know, were those unqualified staff members a material violation?
Right, that's what the Supreme Court sent the case back to the lower courts to figure out. They laid out the framework, that materiality test, but it was up to the lower courts to apply it to this specific case.
Yeah, so they basically said, here are the puzzle pieces. You figure out if they fit.
Exactly, and that's pretty common with Supreme Court decisions. They often clarify the law and then send it back down for others to apply those principles.
Okay, makes sense. So we've covered a lot, but before we dive into how you actually prove materiality, let's do a quick recap.
Sounds good.
We started with this heartbreaking story that led to this huge legal battle, and the Supreme Court ultimately said, hey, this idea of implied false certification, that's a legitimate theory under the FCA.
Right.
But they also made it super clear. Materiality. That's the key.
Right. And remember, materiality isn't just about whether a rule exists. It's about whether the government actually enforces it and whether they would have refused to pay if they knew about the violation.
So the million-dollar question then becomes, how do you prove that something is material in the eyes of the government? That's what we're tackling next.
That is the question. Welcome back to our deep dive on Universal Health Services v. Escobar. I'm excited to keep going on this one, unpacking it with you.
Yeah, me too. Mm-hmm. We left off with this, you know, this big question of how do you prove materiality? And I have a feeling this is where things get really, really tricky.
Yeah.
Because it's not like there's a simple checklist.
Right. No, not at all. Materiality, it's definitely a bit of a moving target, right? It's not about whether something's just inherently wrong or even technically illegal. It really boils down to this. Would the government have changed their decision? Would they have paid if they knew about this violation? And, you know, Escobar does give us some clues on how to figure this out, but yeah, it's tricky.
So help me understand this, right? Let's say I'm a healthcare provider and I accidentally mess up a billing code on a claim, you know, like a minor error.
Yeah.
It doesn't affect the quality of care provided. Would that be considered material under Escobar?
I mean, probably not. The Supreme Court made it really clear that, you know, the FCA isn't supposed to be a gotcha game where you're just trying to catch every tiny administrative mistake. It's meant to target this deliberate fraud that really impacts how the government spends money. So a minor paperwork error, as long as it doesn't really change the substance of the claim, the actual services, it probably wouldn't be considered material.
Okay, that's reassuring for those of us who occasionally, you know, misplace a comma or two.
Yeah.
But let's flip the script, right? What if a healthcare provider is knowingly billing for services that were done by someone who wasn't actually qualified?
Sure.
You know, like we saw in Escobar?
Yeah.
That seems like a much bigger deal.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That goes straight to the heart of this whole implied false certification theory, right? Because by submitting that claim, they're basically saying, hey, these services were done by qualified people.
Yeah.
And if that's not true, that's a misrepresentation, and it could very well be material, right? It goes directly to the integrity of what they're billing for.
Right. It's like this domino effect. The violation impacts the representation made to the government, and then ultimately that impacts their decision to pay.
Right.
And it all hinges on this idea of materiality.
Exactly. And remember, the Supreme Court, they sent the Escobar case back down and they said, okay, lower courts, you got to figure out if these specific violations, in that case, the unqualified staff, were material enough to trigger FCA liability. And this is where things get even more interesting, because you have to start looking at the government's own behavior. Like, what have they done in the past?
Okay, so if I'm a lawyer, let's say I'm building a case or advising a client, how do I figure out what's material to the government? Where do I even start?
Well, the good news is Escobar gives us some guidance there. The Supreme Court, they said it's really important to look at how the government actually pays, like their payment practices. If they routinely pay claims, even though they know about these violations, that's a pretty strong sign that maybe that violation isn't really material to them.
Right.
It's like they're saying, well, we're willing to tolerate this because it doesn't really affect what we care about.
So it's almost like you're trying to establish some kind of legal precedent, but for payment practices.
Yeah, exactly.
So if I'm trying to argue that a violation was material, mm-hmm. I'd want to find examples where the government denied payment for the same kind of violation in the past, even if it wasn't explicitly, you know, a condition of payment.
Yeah, you got it. That's the kind of evidence that could be pretty persuasive in court. You're looking for these patterns in how the government behaves that kind of show you what their priorities are. And of course, if you're on the defense side, you'd want to highlight the opposite, right? Show all those situations where the government paid, even though they knew about those violations.
Yeah, so it's all about showing that track record, how the government acts in real life,
yeah.
Not just what's written in some really dense regulation.
Exactly. Escobar really moves things away from these kind of abstract legal arguments and said, let's look at the practical stuff. How does the government operate? How do they make decisions? What are the things they really focus on when they're paying claims?
It's almost like a reality check for the legal system.
Right.
The law is important, but how it's used in practice is just as important.
Absolutely. And the implications, they go way beyond just FCA cases. Escobar, it kind of highlights this. You got to understand the government's real practices and what they really care about in any situation where you have government contracts or you're dealing with payments. You can't just read the rules literally. You have to see how they're used in the real world.
It's like the difference between reading a travel guide and actually going to a new city.
Right.
The travel guide gives you the basics, but it's that lived experience that gives you the real insight.
Perfect analogy, and it applies perfectly here, right? Escobar tells us if you want to navigate this complex world of government regulations, you have to understand how they behave.
Okay, so we know that proving materiality is super important. But how do you actually do that in court? Like, what kind of evidence is really going to sway a judge?
And that's where things can get super challenging. Because materiality, it ultimately comes down to the subjective judgment about what the government would have done. You can't just go ask them, hey, would you have paid this if you knew this other thing?
So if we can't read the government's mind, how do we figure out what they would have done?
You have to look at the evidence, right? Circumstantial evidence, yeah. And make some reasonable conclusions. And this is where those patterns we were talking about, how the government's behaved in the past, that's where those become so valuable.
So if I'm trying to convince a judge that something was material, I want to show evidence that the government consistently denies payment mm-hmm. for similar violations. Like, what kind of evidence are we talking about specifically?
Yeah, you're thinking along the right lines. Think about things like internal memos, government guidelines that show they're serious about this specific violation, statistical data, you know, that shows a high rate of denials for this type of thing. You could even have testimony from government officials who can say, look, this rule is really important and it affects how we decide whether to pay.
So it's like putting together a puzzle, right? You're taking all these different bits of information and creating this picture of materiality.
Exactly. And then, of course, if you're on the defense, you want to do the opposite. Emphasize all those times when the government paid, even though they knew about those violations.
Right. So it becomes this battle of evidence and arguments, and each side is trying to convince the judge that their view of materiality is the right one.
You got it. And that's what makes Escobar such a game changer. It really shifted things away from that narrow technical reading of the FCA to this broader, more practical look at how the government actually acts and what they prioritize.
Right. It reminds us that the law isn't always black and white, right?
Yeah.
There's a lot of gray area, especially with something like materiality.
Oh, absolutely. And that's part of what makes these cases so interesting, right? They're not just about applying the law. You have to interpret it, understand the nuances, figure out how it works in the real world.
Yeah. And Escobar gave us a whole new playbook for doing that in the context of the FCA.
It did. It's a landmark case, and it's still shaping legal strategies and arguments, even today. Understanding materiality is so essential for anyone working with government contracts or really any government payments.
Well said. And before we jump to the last part of our deep dive, I have a thought-provoking question for you to ponder.
I'm ready. Hit me.
Okay, so if a rule is so inconsistently enforced that its materiality is practically impossible to figure out, does that raise questions about the rule itself?
Oh.
Should the government be clarifying or revising rules that create this kind of legal ambiguity?
That is such a good question. And it really goes to the heart of good regulation, right?
Yeah.
Because you have this tension between establishing clear rules and allowing some flexibility in how they're enforced. We'll dive into that and more in part three of our deep dive. Until then, keep those legal minds sharp.
Welcome back for the final part of our deep dive into Universal Health Services v. Escobar. We've really gone deep on this one, haven't we?
We have. We've explored implied false certification, wrestled with materiality, and now it feels like it's time to tackle those big picture questions about government regulations themselves.
Exactly. This case isn't just about one legal battle, right? It sparks a bigger conversation about how clear regulations are, how effective they are in general. We ended part two with a question that I think really gets at that. You know, if a rule is so inconsistently enforced that you can't even figure out if it's material, does that mean there's a problem with the rule itself?
Such a great question, and it goes right to the heart of effective regulation because you have this tension, right? You want clear guidelines, but you also need some flexibility in how they're enforced.
It's like trying to follow a map where the landmarks keep changing. Like you're trying to comply, but you don't know what you're aiming for because the enforcement is so all over the place.
And that creates so much uncertainty for businesses, especially in areas like healthcare, which are super regulated. It can really stifle innovation if you don't know how a rule is going to be applied. How can you plan for the future?
So what's the solution? Do we just get rid of all these confusing regulations and start over?
I get the appeal of that, you know, just wipe the slate clean. But it's not that easy. Regulations exist for a reason, right? To protect consumers, make sure everyone's playing by the same rules, safeguard the public interest. It's about finding the right balance.
So not about getting rid of rules entirely, but making them clearer, more consistent in how they're enforced, and making sure they actually line up with what the government really prioritizes. It's about making sure the regulations are actually doing what they're supposed to.
Exactly. And Escobar actually gives us some hints about this. Remember how much emphasis the Supreme Court put on the government's own payment practices? That suggests that enforcement should be transparent, consistent. If the government's serious about a rule, their actions should show it, not just the words on paper.
So it's not enough to just have a rule written down somewhere. If they really think it's important, they need to back it up with their enforcement. And what about those rules that are basically ignored or they're enforced so randomly that no one knows what's going on? Does that mean it's time to rethink those rules?
Absolutely. If a rule is just consistently disregarded or it's applied so unevenly, that's a huge red flag for the government. It's time to take a hard look at that rule. Maybe it needs to be clarified, maybe it needs to be rewritten, or maybe it's just time to get rid of it entirely if it's not doing what it's supposed to.
Like pruning a garden.
Right.
Get rid of the dead wood so the healthy plants can thrive. You got to regularly check in and see what's working and what's not.
Love that analogy. It really highlights that regulation shouldn't just be about adding more and more rules. It should also be about refining the ones we already have.
So Escobar wasn't just about clarifying the FCA. It was about making everyone step back and think about the role of regulations in general, how they're enforced.
Right.
It was like a message to the government. Hey, you need to be clear, you need to be consistent, and your regulations need to be effective.
It's a landmark case, not just for the legal stuff, but for how it changed the relationship between the government and those who are regulated by them.
It reminds us that good regulation shouldn't be about creating this maze of confusing rules, right? It's about creating an environment that's predictable and fair. So businesses can operate with confidence and not feel like they're going to be punished randomly.
Well said. And ultimately, that kind of environment helps everyone. Businesses, consumers, and the government itself.
Okay, so we've talked about how Escobar impacts businesses, the government. Mm-hmm. But what about us regular people? How does this affect everyday citizens?
Great question, and the answer might surprise some folks. Remember those quitam provisions we talked about? The ones that let everyday people be whistleblowers and sue on behalf of the government? Escobar actually makes whistleblowers more powerful by clarifying this whole implied false certification idea.
So if you see a company ripping off the government, let's say billing for services they never provided, you've got a stronger tool to hold them accountable now.
Exactly. Escobar removes a huge barrier for whistleblowers. Now, they don't have to prove a rule was specifically labeled as a condition of payment. They just need to show that the violation was material, meaning it would likely change the government's decision to pay.
It gives people the power to speak up, to help make sure taxpayer money isn't being wasted on fraud. It creates a system where everyday citizens can help keep the government accountable.
Absolutely. It's a good reminder that we all have a stake in making sure government funds are used properly and that those who break the rules are held responsible.
So, Escobar, a win for whistleblowers, potentially a push for better regulation, and hopefully a win for taxpayers in the end.
I think that's a great way to sum up this case. It's definitely been complex and impactful.
Well, there you have it, legal enthusiasts. We've made it to the end of our deep dive into Universal Health Services v. Escobar. We unpacked implied false certification, tackled materiality, and explored how this case has impacted businesses, the government, and regular people like you and me.
It's a case that people are still debating and analyzing, and we're still seeing the ripple effects today. It reminds us that the law is always changing, always evolving.
And if you're hungry for more, make sure to check out the show notes. We've got links to the full court opinions and some really insightful legal analyses.
And as always, keep those legal minds sharp.
That's it for this deep dive. We'll catch you next time for another fascinating journey through the world of law. Until then, stay curious.